Everybody, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And y'all that have been here for the history presentation earlier and everything, you're going to be so tired of hearing my voice by the end of tonight. But I thank you all for having me. And from what I understand, it's a little special tonight. We have food and a little history presentation because it is the 20th anniversary of this group. Am I right?
Yes.
All right. 20 years, that's a long time of helping shaky people that come here realize that, you know what, maybe it is all right. Maybe I can live. I mean, what a feeling. Like, I mean, maybe I can do this thing. It's great. And y'all have done a good job for a very long time. You certainly don't need me to come here and tell you that. You know that. You know what you've been doing. I'm glad you read what you read on page 29 here. I'm not here to give lectures or it ain't going to be a big book workshop. I love the big book, but I'm no expert on it. And I love some of our other literature, too. I'm here to share in my own words and in my own way what the AA program has meant to me and how I cultivated a relationship with the God of my understanding. And I hope that's what I can do. And I really admire speakers that I don't care if they've got 60 minutes, 30 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever it is, halfway through, they're done talking about drinking and they are in AA. And then they eloquently and intelligently go through the steps, one step, second step, third step. You're not gonna get that tonight from me. My hope is that you hear AA throughout my story. My sobriety date is February 24th, 1978. And I was told if I never forgot that date, I'd never have to memorize another one. Now that don't mean I'm gonna fall over drunk if I forget the actual date that I came to AA. But what it does mean is if I forget where I came from, I'm going back. It's just that simple. Now, there's some significant sobriety in this room. So me having 46 years isn't impressing anybody in here. And how much time somebody has should never impress anybody. I was taught early on that sobriety is measured by its depth, not by its length. I know people have been sober 30 years. I wouldn't ask them for directions to the Piggly Wiggly. I'm not kidding you about that. I don't want nothing they have. I don't want nothing they have. And I know people that have been sober just 3, 4, 5 years that I would bare my soul to, that I would have no problem going to with something that was heavy on my heart because I know that they're doing the deal and that I'm going to get an answer, some help that has humility in it. So if you're new, if there are any newer people in here, you think, wow, sober 46 years. First of all, there's people in this room been sober longer than that. Please don't be impressed. Now, clearly, if you're sober a long time, you're doing something right. I mean, I'm not saying time doesn't mean anything, but what really separates somebody who is really living this thing as opposed to just have memorized a bunch of one-liners from the big book and can spit them out easily is what they do before and after the meetings, what they do in between meetings. I was told, watch the action. Watch how people treat other people, especially. Somebody can sound like Mr. AA in the meeting. Oh, my God, they're quoting the big book backwards and forwards. And they nothing they don't know. My God, they must be a guru here in this AA. And you go out to eat with them and they treat the waitress like crap. You learn a lot about somebody when you go out to eat with them. So I believe the longer I'm sober, the less I know. And sometimes when you're sober a long time, people ask you, well, what's the most important thing about long-term sobriety? And I wouldn't even pretend to tell you what's the most important thing. I mean, obviously, well, don't drink and don't die. You hear that one all the time. That can't be any truer than that. But I believe what's at the top of the list would be to remain teachable. Now, I went through a phase where there was nothing I didn't know about AA. I call it the super sober syndrome. I've seen it hit other people. It usually happens around 5 years, 7 years, maybe. And most of us go through it. And the people who have been through it are very, very, usually very, very patient. Some get stuck in it a little longer than they should be. But when I was in my super sober syndrome phase, boy, I tell you, there wasn't nothing I didn't know. I quote the book backwards and forth. I mean, I was excited. I loved AA. I really was into this thing. It's not like I was a total phony or anything, but I was just getting a little too full of myself. And I had led a meeting one night. And oh my God, that group was so, so lucky that I was there to lead that night. And it was an eloquent lead. Oh my goodness gracious. I thought I saw somebody levitating in the back. And I was very happy with how I had led that meeting. And after the meeting in the parking lot, you know, we're all smoking cigarettes in those days. And this woman named Marge, who I absolutely adored. This woman was an icon to me. I just loved her. I would later find out that she went to meetings with my mother. Neither one of us knew that at the time. And she liked me, and we had good conversations, and she was very helpful to me in an appropriate way. And she comes up to me, and she takes a drag off her cigarette. She's one of them space violators. You know the ones, right? The ones that get up close on you, no matter what. You can back up all you want. They're just going to keep inching towards you. So she was a little bitty thing. She got in my face, and she said, "Mike, it's what you learn after you know it all that counts." And then she turned around and walked away. I was devastated. I said, Marge, what do you mean? What do you mean? And she explained to me what she meant. Well, it couldn't have been a week later. I'm leading another meeting, and I'm equally pleased with myself at that meeting as well. That group was very lucky, too, that I was there. And a guy came up to me after the meeting. This guy got, he's an old World War II veteran, been sober forever. And he comes up, and it's a big thing about smoking cigarettes, takes a drag off his cigarette, and he looks at me, and he keeps looking over top of my head. I'm like, "What, Henry, what are you looking at?" He says, "I'm just looking for that halo that's going to come down and slip around your neck and choke you." So message received. I got a little humble pie there. And today, man, I'm just grateful. I know I don't know everything. I know I need you people. I don't think about how many meetings I need to go to. I just love being here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people in AA, even our problem children. You know, they're part of the deal. You know, we have some menaces to serenity around these meetings, right? I mean, we know that. But I mean, they're part of the deal too. You know, what's that thing you hear in AA all the time? Well, we're not exactly a hotbed of mental health. Well, that's the truth. We're not. But I love the whole, I just love AA. And I need to remember where I came from. I do not, sometimes you hear people say they have a built-in forgetter, and I understand it's in our literature. I do not have a built-in forgetter. I have never had a built-in forgetter. And I pray to God that I never get one. I ask God every day to never, ever let me forget where I came from, and that without him working through you people, I'm nothing. You guys are the local reps. The God of my understanding works through you people, whether you like it or not, you're the local reps. And I believe every time I come to an AA meeting, I'm telling everybody in the room, I need you. And I don't kid myself about that for a second. I'm no guru. I'm not in here to bless you with my presence and my wisdom. I need you guys. And that's just the fact. So I always remember that. I was raised in an alcoholic home. And when I say that, that's not like, "Oh, poor little Mikey born in an alcoholic home." I heard this Al-Anon say this years ago, and I've been repeating it ever since. They said, it's not about blame. It's about understanding. On a scale of 1 to 10, an alcoholic family's about in the middle, plenty worse, some not as bad. My parents were good people who loved their children. I want to make that clear. They were good people who loved their children. But when cunning, baffling, and powerful is in the house, there can be no peace. And there was no peace in that house. In my memory, when I was a little kid, I'd be laying awake in bed at night, seemed like I never got a good night's sleep. I'd hear all this arguing and fighting and yelling and screaming. Every time I'd hear a door slam, I'd flinch. Every time I'd hear some glass break, I'd flinch. And every time I'd flinch, I'd get a little sicker and a little sicker. I was wound up some kind of tight, man. I felt everything and I understood nothing. There was something way wrong with me before I ever took a drink. Years later, when I come to AA and they said, alcohol is but a symptom. There's deeper underlying causes. I was like, well, no kidding, Sparky. I hope you got more for me than that. I've been knowing that. We might be sick, but we ain't stupid. And so I knew there was something wrong with me. And I witnessed the power of alcohol at a very early age. I got sober when I was 24. I'm 70 now. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. But I used to be the young person in AA. Not anymore, man. I don't know if any of y'all noticed when I was up here bending over to get my water and said, "Oh my God, everything hurts." Anyway, so I witnessed the power of alcohol. Both my parents were in the Army in World War II, and they were medical people, and they weren't calling them MASH units then. I think in World War II they were calling them field hospitals, and so that's how they met. And years and years later, I would read some letters between them when they were on the same unit for a while. Then they were separated. Some letters between them, and my mother was the alcoholic in the family. Turns out there would be like 4 out of 6 of us alcoholics, but she was the alcoholic. And I remember reading those letters, and for the first time in my life, I was much older, sober many years. My oldest sister had them. I read those letters that my mother had written to my father during the war. And I realized I wasn't seeing, my alcoholic mother anymore. I was seeing a young woman in her early 20s that was witnessing the horrors of war, seeing things that people just shouldn't have to see. Now, we all know that the combatants suffer and sometimes they'll pay the ultimate price. But you know what? The people that put the pieces together, they suffer too. They suffer too. And I remember her being just wound up tight. She was just wound up tight. Good woman, smart woman, loved her children, but fight for her children. Very good person. And I was sick a lot when I was a kid. Since they were in the Army, I was born at Walter Reed in D.C. And I remember her picking me up from the hospital and taking me home one day. I couldn't have been 5 years old. And sitting in the front seat of the car, we're going up Georgia Avenue, big old 57 Chrysler, man, thing, but thing was huge. And no seat belts, everything's metal. It's crazy. And she stopped at this little liquor store called the Cork and Bottle on Georgia Avenue. I don't know if it's still there now, but it was still there a few years ago. I couldn't believe it. I said, my God, this liquor store is still here. So she pulls into the liquor store and she leaves me in a car. I see her go inside and she gets a bottle of, what would be whiskey. I didn't know what it was, but that's what she got. And she came back out to the car and she sat down. She got behind the wheel and she was wound up tight like this. And my mother, I'm sure she didn't weigh 100 pounds. And she cracked the seal on that bottle of whiskey and she tipped that bottle up and she about drained it. And everybody in this room knows exactly what happened after that. She went from this to just relax. So I witnessed the power of alcohol at an early age. And even then, this is when you know you're headed for trouble. Even at that age, I'm wondering, daggone, what's in that? What is in that that makes that happen? I mean, I'm five, so I'm not really formulating it like that. But looking back, that's what I was thinking. And I remember coming home from school one day. And this was me witnessing Alcoholics Anonymous without knowing it. And there's a strange car out in front of the house. And I went in and I could hear some women back in my mother's bedroom. And so I tiptoed down the hall and I'm looking through the door, the crack in the door. And y'all know that picture of the man on the bed. Well, this was like the woman on the bed. And these two women, who I didn't know it then, but clearly they had come from Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a good old-fashioned 12-step call, is what I was witnessing. They had brought her a little care package. They had like some oranges and something to drink. And for all I know, they had some K-Rose syrup. I don't know what they had. But anyway, they were talking and they were laughing. I heard laughter. It'd been so long since I heard laughter in that house. And I didn't want them to leave, man. I thought, wow, this is something. What is going on here? And when they left, when they went to get in their car, I ran to the window and I'm peeking through the blinds. And I wanted one of them to turn around and look. But they never did. They just got in the car and he went away. And I never forgot that. I never forgot that. Of course, what I was witnessing was one of the most powerful things in Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step call. And when I got sober, and I ain't trying to sound like an old person, but in normal days, we made 12-step calls all the time. We went on 12-step calls a lot. And it was kind of exhilarating in a weird sort of way. It was, and my sponsor was really good about teaching me. And I could never figure out, is he teaching me, like, because he's trying to make me think he thinks I'm going to stay sober, or is he really just doing what he thinks is his job? Training this guy to how to carry the message. I think it was probably the latter. But anyway, whenever we were in a house, I would always be very aware of who was in the house, and if there were any children in the house, I would try to make eye contact with them and give them a little wink, a thumbs up, anything. And when we would walk back out to the car, I always turned around and looked back at the house. About half the time, there'd be a little face in the window. Little face in the window. I can remember once a drunk woman showed up to our meeting. Can you imagine that? A drunk person at the AA meeting. I love how people get indignant about it. Now, if they're tipping tables over and stuff, we got a problem. But I'll tell you what, though, if I'm the biggest guy in the room and somebody starts acting up, I'm going to be preaching love and tolerance. I see some big boys in here. I see one of you guys. I'm going to go sit by you. I'll say, hey, you can't behave like that in here. But anyway, so she's drunk and we knew her and she'd been in and out. Just one of those cases, like a lot of us know, that just break your heart. They seem to be trying so hard, but they just can't seem to get it. And I don't judge people like that. I just, our co-founder Bill W. went to his grave almost obsessed with why some people get this thing and some don't. And I'm not talking about the guy who's every shared, every meeting's a disaster report and everything is everybody else's fault. You never hear him talk about a sponsor or steps or anything like that. It's like he gets drunk. It's like, really? It's like it's not a big surprise. But I mean, I've known people over the years that it seems like they're doing the deal. They're trying really, really hard. And I don't know what it is. Maybe they got obstacles I can't see. And this woman was one of those. And she accidentally left her purse in the meeting. And so my wife and some others, they looked in her purse and they got her driver's license, which she had, which was amazing. And so we looked up her address and we drove to her house. And I got elected to drop the purse off. And as I approached the house, if Norman Rockwell would paint a picture of what family alcoholism looks like, as I approached the house, it's like I'm not a real estate guy, a colonial, maybe two-story brick house. And as I approached the house, I could see through the bay window in the living room, I could see her and what I'm imagining was her husband arguing. You could hear them out on the street. But as soon as I got out of the car, I could hear them, and all the doors and windows were closed, and I could hear them, and arms flailing like this, and there's yelling and screaming going on. And then I looked up towards the top windows there, and there were silhouettes of a couple little kids looking out the window. And I knocked on the door, and the husband barks out, "What do you want?" And I said, "She left her purse there. Set it down." So I did. And I walked back to the car and I took another look back at the house, and it just broke my heart. Just broke my heart. So I knew there was nothing I could do about it. I knew what it sounded like in that house. I knew what it smelled like in that house. I knew what it felt like in that house. And I also knew there was nothing I could do about it. Nothing I could do about it. So whenever I tell my story, or whenever I listen to a story, what I'm looking for is a spiritual story. I mean, that's kind of what we just read here, you know, how we establish a relationship with the God of our understanding. And what I listen for is if they had a relationship with God, I listen for that departure. Or if they didn't have a relationship with God, I listen for that apartness. And then the ensuing chaos and pain, and that happens when we're self-will run riot, until if we're lucky and we live, we can come crawling back into here and ask for help. And then I listen for being brought back to God. And I think, you know, I'm not like trying to be a professor of AA, like every AA story should have these elements, you know, but I mean, but that's what I listen for. And my story is no different. I got a little spiritual story just like the rest of y'all. And I went to Catholic school. And before I say another word, I want to make it absolutely clear. I am not doing any Catholic bashing. I'm not bashing religion in general. That's not good AA. That's not what our literature teaches us. And I'm at peace with all of that stuff now. But I loved it. I would go to mass every morning before school. And they were doing the mass in Latin in those days. And it was just beautiful to me. And I'd sit up front if I could. And I'd you know, look through the stained glass window as the morning sunshine would just be filling up the area, the altar and everything. I'd look up at Jesus on the cross, and I felt something. I really did. I felt something, but I couldn't square it with what was going on at home, all the chaos and the yelling and the fighting and the fear of what was going on at home. And I prayed, oh my God, I prayed every day. I prayed for the noise to stop and it got louder. I prayed for the fighting to stop and it just got more intense. I prayed for people to live and they died. I just, it hurt. This, I, my little, you know, 8, 9, 10 year old mind can't. I don't know what's going on here. I can't deal with this. So I started doing what a lot of us do. I got a feeling I'm in a room full of them. You know, I started acting up in school. Anybody here ever act up in school? Oh, come on, one or two hands. Okay. You know, this thing of honesty. You got to get honest to get this thing. I'll just say anyway. So I started acting up in school. And we weren't in the schoolhouse one day. We were actually in church. This is St. Michael's in Silver Spring, Maryland. By the way, I only mentioned that because I've told my story as far away as Texas and had somebody come up to me and say, "I went to St. Michael's." That's a, of course you did. You're an AA. That school cranked out a lot of alcoholics. I'm sure it cranked out a lot of, you know, great students and all of that. Just get that in there. But I'm telling you, there's a plethora of St. Michael's alum in AA. So we were over in church one day, and I cut up a little bit, and the nun came over, and she did what they do. You know, she smacked me upside the head. It's not her fault. It's what they're supposed to do. And when she turned her back, I did something inappropriate. Please don't judge. I didn't even know what it meant. I'd seen older kids do it, but I flipped her off. And I learned a couple of things right away. The first thing I learned was that your friends will snitch on you in a heartbeat. The second thing I learned is nuns don't like that. They do not like that. And she came over there and she yanked me out of that pew and she dragged me across Wayne Avenue over into the schoolhouse. And she takes me up to the classroom, which was empty. And here I am standing in front of a nun in full habit, complete with a crucifix, surrounded by pictures of Mary, Jesus, and Joseph. And she picks up my desk. She dumps all of my books onto the floor. And she says, "Leave and don't come back." Now, in my little 10-year-old eyes, that was God telling me to leave and don't come back. So a lot of people, when they get to the part of their story where they're talking about their departure from God, it's a gradual thing. It happens over time. They get a little older. Maybe they're interested in girls or boys or something, you know, and they drift away from the church. With me, it was like, pow, it was that day. And I knew, even though I was only 10 years old, I knew something very big in my life had just happened. I didn't know what, you know, my mind's just too immature to really articulate any of it or have any sort of useful constructive thoughts about it. But I knew my life was going to be different and that something big had just happened. And I can remember walking home down Wayne Avenue with my heavy, heavy book bag because all of my books were in it. Every step I took, I could hear them little straps hitting the back of the backpack. And I just knew my life's going to be different. So I'm 46 years sober. I'm 70 years old. My head still spins to this day when I think of the swiftness and the completeness of my demise. I was not somebody that eased into this alcohol thing. I was not somebody who was leading any kind of a normal life and then my drinking got out of hand. I mean, I went full tilt from day one and I never looked back. I never looked back. And, you know, how do you get to AA when you're 24 years old? Well, I'll tell you what. You drink like I did and you don't have any soft landings, you won't get here. I'd have never lived to be an old alcoholic. Nobody was coming up to me when I got here and said, oh, it's so nice to see you young people come in. You won't have to go through what we went through. It's like, oh no, I wasn't hearing that. They were saying things to me like, man, you're coming in the best way possible. You got nowhere to go but up. And that was the absolute truth. Within a few short years, I had become a chronic runaway. I got run all through the juvenile system. I had a thing about stealing cars. I mean, I was just so out of control. I got thrown out of every school I ever went to. By the time I was 14, I was a fallen down, blackout drunk, totally out of control. And I kept winding up in places that ended with Children's Center. You know, I was in the Waxter's Children's Center in Maryland. And I did a lot of ripping and running in D.C. And their juvenile facility was called the Receiving Home. That almost sounds like a nice place, doesn't it? The Receiving Home for Children. Oh, man, I got to tell you, I've been in adult jails that weren't as bad as that place. I mean, that place was horrible. It eventually didn't do me any good. I was out of there for a long time. It eventually got shut down. And when they shut that place down, the judge that shut it down said this place wasn't fit to put an animal in. You know, so I did. And so these are the places I wound up. Now, I don't know about the rest of y'all, but I may have been looking for a little sympathy when I got here. Anybody else? Oh, I see a couple of heads nodding. Okay. All right. At least I'm not the only one. And when I used to get to this part of my story, I would say, and everything I'm about to say is absolutely true. Mom and dad died when I was a teenager. And then I wound up sleeping in the woods, like poor little me. Now that's true. And that happened. It was sad, very sad. But what I was leaving out was that I had two older sisters who loved me more than anything in the world. Anything in the world. I was the youngest in the family. I was the baby of the family, especially my oldest sister. She was much more like a mother than a sister. And they did everything they could to help me. They took me into their homes. They fed me. They clothed me. They gave me every opportunity to succeed. I was beyond human help. I was beyond human help. And I did what we do to the people that love us. And I hated myself for it, but I couldn't stop. I forced them to watch me commit slow motion suicide right in front of their eyes. And they did what they had to do, each in their turn. And it put me out, put me out. So now I'm living on the streets and I'm mad at everybody. I'm angry. I was an angry little drunk. I was never capable of any violence, not a violent person. So it didn't matter how angry I was. Nobody was scared of me, but I was angry. Oh my God. And I was dramatic too, man. And I wasn't angry at the police. I was never angry at my parents. I was never angry at my sisters. Even when they kicked me out, I was actually relieved. The last time my oldest sister kicked me out, I was actually relieved because I knew I would just keep hurting her over and over and over. And I felt horrible about it. I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know how to stop. So I wasn't angry at any of them. None of them. I was angry at God. That's who I was angry at. I would cuss him out. I'd go to the church I got thrown out of when I was a kid, and I would pull on the doors late at night, and they're locked, of course. And I was dramatic. I'd shake my fist up. There was a big gold cross at the point of the, oh man, I was terrible. And then I'd say blasphemous things, hoping that, you know, like God's going to show himself to me. I'm going to be so out of control and blasphemous. He's going to, you know, yeah, come on down here. You know what? You might be the one asking me for forgiveness. I mean, I was terrible. And I'd stumble around the side of the church, flop down in the grass between right underneath the window that I used to sit on the other side of when I was a child. And I would look up at that outside of that window, and I would remember those mornings at Mass and how I felt. And there's just not a word in my vocabulary where I can describe. I mean, I was just like, I mean, bewildered. I mean, I don't know, but it's like bewildered times 10. It was just, I was just lost, I guess is the best way to put it. I just felt lost. I didn't know what to do. Even when you're homeless, they didn't call us homeless, then they called us bums, then they started calling people street people, then they called them homeless, which I think is perfectly appropriate. Now they're unhoused persons, but whatever. I didn't have anywhere to go, and nobody else wanted me. And so my sister, my oldest sister, had moved out to LA to try to get the heck away from us, I guess. And I was like the little brother from you know where. I turned up out there on her doorstep, and she tried one more time to help me. One more time to help me. You know what I did? I did the same thing over and over and over again. And the last night before she put me out, that I, well, she had actually put me out, and I went back to her apartment to try to put the touch on her for, you know, $10 or, you know, something to eat, something. And I remember standing in her living room, and I'm swaying like this, and like I can't fight. I'm a terrible fighter. I'm not a violent person. I really don't want to fight, but apparently I'm a little mouthy when I drink. And people who were good at fighting would practice on me, I suppose, because I was forever. Oh my God, drunks that wear glasses, we have a whole nother level of difficulty. Jeez, I was walking around all the time, glasses busted up like this, knots on my head. And I even remember this guy telling me, he said, "Mike, you seem like a nice guy. How come you're all, you're always beat up?" I said, I know, right? I don't know. I am a nice guy." And so I was in that condition. I'd been beat up, and I had my father's field jacket from like World War II, and it was all tore up. I still have it today. I mean, I wish I didn't abuse it like I did. It's just like literally rags on a hanger. I'm trying to preserve it as best I can. And all I remember is she's sitting on the couch, and tears are just streaming down her face. And she's begging me, literally begging me to tell her, "Why are you doing this to yourself? Why? I mean, we had just lost our mother, you know, our father. Our father died of cancer. He didn't die of alcoholism, but our mother did. And, you know, how can you do this? Why are you doing this to yourself?" And I'm sure everybody in this room has looked into the eyes of somebody that loved them, and they were probably red and filled with tears, and they asked you the same question: "Why are you doing this to yourself? Why?" And I probably said the most honest thing I'd ever said in my life. I said, "I don't know. I don't know, but I know this much. I can't stop." And I don't mean I can't stop like, oh, I tried to stop and I just can't. I never tried to stop. Why would I? It was the only thing keeping me glued together. I knew I was condemned to death if I continued to drink, but I also knew I could not stay glued together without it. That's bottom. That's being between a rock and a hard place. And I stayed there for a while. I did not know what to do. I knew that life without the anesthetic was intolerable. Intolerable. My alcoholic credentials are impeccable. I am a real alcoholic. I don't know when they started saying that. I mean, I know it's in the book, but you didn't used to hear that. I'm a real alcoholic. It's like, okay. Like, as opposed to, you know, so my alcoholic credentials are, I mean, I'm an alcoholic. Being a child of the 60s and 70s, I am highly qualified, and I mean highly qualified for at least half a dozen other programs that end with an A. My personal experience is that Alcoholics Anonymous has solved all of my problems. That's just me. That's just my experience. Do what you want with that information. But just to let you know, man, I was out there. There's a friend of mine back home. He says he was looking for anything to get him interplanetary travel. That's what he was looking for. And so I needed that anesthetic, and without it, life was intolerable. And I was just stuck. I was just stuck. I'm a terrible criminal, a horrible criminal. My customary charges were disorderly conduct, destruction of property. Apparently, I like the sound of breaking glass. And you know, when you get locked up, your status in jail is the severity of your crime. And so I was always the butt of everyone's jokes. because I did like just stupid stuff. I tried to rob a little tavern. It's a fast food joint up in DC with a ball peen hammer. I demanded all the money in the cash register and 100 cheeseburgers. Oh man, they read that in court and people are laughing and I got to go back to the cell block. It was terrible. It was terrible. So I'm a terrible criminal, terrible criminal. But I, you know, I'm just so distraught. And I got to do something. I'm sick of this. And I'm walking around the streets of LA and I said, you know what? I'm going to rob a liquor store. That's what I'm going to do. Now, that's quite a jump up from your career trespasser, you know, robbing a liquor store. But I had been in a liquor store that got robbed once, so I felt like I had training. When you're in DC, you could drink when you were 18, which meant you could drink when you were 15. I mean, I was just talking about it with somebody the other day. I got served in a bar called Sparky's on Georgia Avenue when I was 15 years old. Anyway, so I went into this liquor store and a guy had walked in right in front of me and he went over and he got a six pack of beer from the cooler and he was standing in front of me in line and I saw some money fall to the floor. Clearly it came out of his pocket. So I reached down, I pick up the money. I said, hey man, you dropped some money. And he's just acting like he doesn't hear me. Then I tap him on his elbow. I say, hey man, you dropped some money. He's going like, oh, what is wrong with this man? I know he hears me. And then he turned around and I knew what was wrong with him. Nothing. He was robbing the place. He was significantly taller than me. I'll never forget it. He had a chrome pistol of some sort. And he just paused. He was holding it like this. It was pointing dead at my chest and pauses and looks at me like, you dumb so-and-so. Can't you see I'm robbing this place? And I was terrified. I didn't even want to look at him. He walked out. I didn't even look because I thought he might shoot me. The guy behind the counter, he'd been robbed so many times, it didn't faze him at all. He's on the phone to the police. He's keeping the line moving, making change out of his pocket. He asked me if I'd stay and wait for the police. I said, sure, I'll be right back. No, I'm not staying for the police. Anyway, so I felt like I had training. And I knew where I could get a gun, and I got my hands on a gun, and it was loaded. But I'm not shooting anybody, which that's how bright I was. If you're not going to shoot anybody, what the heck you got a gun for? Because they're going to shoot you. Anyway, I'm just not the sharpest tool in the shed, what I'm saying here, if you're getting the picture. And so I'd scoped out this liquor store, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm about half drunk. If picture Barney Fife robbing a liquor store. I mean, that's what I was like. That's the first time I ever said that. I like that. I'm going to use it. Barney Fife robbing a liquor store. Anyway, so I'd scoped out my liquor store, and I go in there, and I was happy to see there wasn't anybody in there except the guy behind the counter. And I went over to the cooler, and I got a six-pack of beer, and I came up to the counter, and I set it down like I'd seen my mentor do. And I noticed a couple of things right away. The guy behind the counter was huge. Oh my God, he had to be like 6'4", 210 pounds, none of it fat. And I'm like, ooh, I'm getting a little jaundice right there. Like, you sure you want to do this? You know, so I noticed a sign was taped to the back of the cash register, said mandatory 5-year prison sentence for any crime committed in the state of California with a handgun. Y'all, I am not prison material. I mean, I've been in a county jail. I can do a little bit of that, but five years, mandatory five years. Like, don't they have San Quentin out here? I'm thinking, I'm not sure I want to do this after all. So I got the gun in one pocket and I got $2 in the other pocket. And I'm going, you know, gun, $2. I don't know what to do. I don't know how much time went by, but finally, a guy behind the counter leans forward and goes, anything else? Like that, and I went, you know, pulled the $2 out and I threw it on the counter and I said, give me a pack of Cools. I'll tell you how long ago that was. I got change back from $2 for a pack of cigarettes and a six pack. I understand that's not happening today. And so, you know, I take my little six pack and my wounded pride and I go out to the beach. And I had never been overtly suicidal. I mean, there were times I just kind of wished I was dead. I would cross the street without looking. That's true as can be. Up, and I'd hear the brakes come on. You know what I'd hear is probably something y'all heard all the time too. Yeah, what's the matter with you? And I'd go, I don't know. I'm like, I get that question a lot. But I was never really overtly suicidal. And so I'm out on the beach and I'm pounding these beers down and I'm just berating myself. You useless piece of crap. And I had been told that all my life. I was useless, worthless, no good. And I said, they're right. You are. You're a piece of crap. You're nothing. I said, you ought to take that gun and shoot yourself. You know, like I said, and to this day, I don't believe I was really serious, but oh my God, did I come close? So I start playing around with this pistol and I put the barrel to the side of my head. And even though it was a double action revolver, I pulled the hammer back for dramatic effect, I suppose. And a couple of things occurred to me right away. First of which was, this could be dangerous what you're doing. But then it was something, I don't know. Some people say it was a moment of clarity or whatever. I don't know, but it was like a rational thought. Was like, do you really want to do this? And I need to make it clear, this had nothing to do with being afraid. I was not afraid of being dead. I wasn't too crazy about being slowly tortured to death, but I was not afraid of being dead. It had nothing to do with fear. I cringe when I hear people say they didn't have the guts to kill themselves. It doesn't take guts to kill yourself. It's easy to kill yourself. We're built to want to live. Don't apologize for that. And so I decided not yet, not yet. And I realized kind of how easy that would be. And I thought, I can do that anytime. I don't need to do it right now. I used to say when I would get this to this part of my story that it was only by God's grace that I didn't pull the trigger. Only by God's grace. I believe in each and every one of us, certainly in me, there's this little glow deep down inside. It's almost snuffed out, but every single person that's in recovery had it. And it's desire. Desire for what? Desire to live, desire for something different. Desire, that little glow was there. It was almost snuffed out, but it was there. So I used to say it was only by God's grace I didn't pull the trigger. And I was speaking at a local neighborhood meeting once, and a brother and sister who are in the program who I just absolutely adore. And as those words came tumbling out of my mouth, I remembered that they had a brother who committed suicide by shooting himself in the head. And I thought to myself, my God, what am I saying? Now, there was nothing in their body language or their looks on their faces like I'd said something hurtful. But I realized, what am I saying? Am I saying that their brother didn't get God's grace? He didn't count? God picks and chooses. You pull the trigger, you don't. You die in that drunk driving accident. You kill somebody in a drunk driving accident. You're just fine. You drive all over the country, falling down drunk, never hurt a fly. You just, I can't do that. I can't do that. It just opens up a theological can of worms that I'm not messing with. And so I don't say that anymore. I don't know. I don't know. I think that's the only thing that has a modicum of humility. Now, there's plenty of people that would come up and explain it to me. That's fine. That's what you believe. That's fine. That's fine. The people that say it's only by God's grace, I didn't do this or I didn't do that. Or, God helped me that night and I'm still alive because of it. I mean, I used to take meetings to the prison. Some of those guys are sitting in there for killing somebody. So I don't say it's only by God's grace I didn't kill myself or anybody else. It may be, but I don't know. I'm not going to say that anymore. I'm just grateful that I'm alive. And I can say this, suicide is a part of our world. It's just a part of our world. I'd be shocked if half the people in here didn't know somebody that killed themselves. I'd be shocked. If there's anybody in this room who's lost somebody they love to suicide, I know I have. I'm here to tell you that God loved them every bit as much as He loves you or me. Why some pull the trigger and some don't, I can't answer that. I don't know. And the naysayers got a lot of ammo, and I ain't arguing with them. I'm just going to say, I don't know. I can't answer that. I can't answer that. So I'm going to leave that alone. So it never gets better. It only gets worse. I wind up back east, and I've been shot at, stabbed, beat so bad I couldn't walk. I've been in jails from D.C. to Florida. And I spent a lot of my drinking on the streets. And I don't mean sleeping in a nice little homeless shelter with a washer and dryer and a color TV. I mean sleeping in the woods, sleeping in parking garage stairwells, sleeping in your car if you left it unlocked. I called them abandoned cars. An abandoned car to me was in a car that was parked with nobody in it. And that was always good with some surprise looks on people's faces in the morning, I'll tell you that. And I don't say any of that like I'm trying to impress anybody. That's just my story. That's just the way I drank. This is how you get to AA at 24. I mean, I was just full tilt. And I was out in beautiful Langley Park, Maryland. It's a tough little neighborhood just outside of DC. And I had a great career going at the car wash there, New Hampshire Avenue Car Wash. And when I wasn't sleeping in the woods next to the car wash, I was sleeping on the floor of a cockroach infested room with a couple other drunks in Langley Park apartments. And this is the condition I was in when I reached out for help. My mother had taken me to an AA meeting when I was about 9 years old. And the only thing I remember about that meeting is the people there were happy. There was, as we used to say in the 70s, there was a good vibe in the room. I mean, the people there were happy. There was a lot of energy in the room. That's all I remembered about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about AA. I didn't know anything about the steps. I didn't know anything about growing spiritually or any of that. All I remembered is the people in that room were happy. They seemed to like each other. There was this just really good energy in that room. That's all I remembered. That is the only reason I called Alcoholics Anonymous on the night of February 24th, 1978. I hadn't had a drink that day, and I am shaking like this, and I'm at the point where I am going to pull the trigger, and I thought, I remembered that meeting from all those years ago when I was a little kid. And I thought, well, what's the harm? Give him a call. And so I went down to this thing called a phone booth. I looked in this thing called a phone book and I looked up AA. You think it'd be easy, right? Got to be page one. AA. No, it's hard. It's AL apparently. And so I struggled and I found it because I really wanted this thing. And, I dropped a quarter in a slot, and I'll never forget what the guy who answered the phone said. He said, "Alcoholics Anonymous, may I help you?" I had no idea how my life was going to change over the next few hours. No idea. So I told him the truth. I said, "Well, I don't know if you can help me or not." I told him my sad little tale, and they were smart in them days. He didn't tell me where a meeting was. He knew it wouldn't go. He said, "We'd like to have somebody come by and talk to you. Maybe take you to a meeting. Would that be all right?" I'm like, they ain't selling nothing. They're giving it away, but it sure sounded like a pitch to me. You go like, okay. I did phone soliciting for a while. I apologize to all of you, but they always taught us to end with okay. Yeah, can I sign you up, Mr. Jones? Okay. Anyway, so I said, well, of course, yes. Send somebody by. So he told me what time they'd come by, and I went back into my little cockroach infested room, and a couple of guys I was living with were drinking and carrying on. And I'm not drinking. I don't want to drink anymore. I don't want to live like this anymore. And as sick as I was physically, I'm not drinking. And at the appointed time, I see this old Chevrolet come rolling up 14th Avenue. A man named Dan O was driving it, a man who had become my sponsor and remained my sponsor for over 30 years until he passed away in 2009. Had a guy named Bob A riding shotgun, who I would later find out just got out of the nut house. And he parks in front of my building, and he gets out of the car. He leaves Bob in the car, and he approaches my building. He opens up the door to the hallway, and he's hit with the stench of urine and some stale booze and some wacky weed floating around the hallway. And he climbs some dirty stairs and knocks on a brown, dented up metal door. And when I opened that door, he stuck his hand out and he said, "Hi, I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic." I never had a problem saying I was an alcoholic. I wound up in a nut house out in LA once when I was living on the streets, and they told me I was not an alcoholic. Can you imagine that? In fairness to the mental health community, I think they know better now. I had to remind them they found me in a parking lot. I knew I was a drunk. And they said, "You're not an alcoholic, Mike. You're too young." I think I was 20 at the time. Right then and there, I knew more than they did. And I said, "Okay, well, then what's my problem?" Because they had been using words, that $50 words that I didn't know what they meant. And this dude they were describing sounded plenty, plenty sick. And they said, "Mike, what you have is severe. Emphasis on severe emotional problems. And when we straighten those out, your drinking will straighten out." And I'm like, "God, you guys went to school for this? Are you kidding me?" So I never had a problem saying I was an alcoholic. So Dan extends his hand. "Hi, I'm Dan. I'm an alcoholic." And I put my hand out and I say, "I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic." And the instant that our hands touched, I became part of a chain reaction that started in Akron, Ohio in 1935 when two drunks discovered they could do together what they could not do by themselves. And I love AA history. I can talk about it forever. Y'all got an earful day. But the short version is, them two went looking for a third one, them three went looking for a fourth one, and here we are today, almost 9 decades later, with recoveries all around the world, millions of them, for almost 90 years. I don't know how you calculate the numbers. There's 2 million people in AA, but yeah, that's right now. What about all of the people that got sober, stayed sober, and passed away sober? It's got to be in the tens of millions over the years. And then what about the families that were affected by it? We're all part of that chain reaction, everybody in this room. And they take me out to the car and they put me in the back seat. And the big book says that alcohol has a way of beating us into a state of unreasonableness. And before I forget, remember that church I told you about I got thrown out of? In that very building where I was thrown out of, there's an AA meeting in the basement. And this is me trying to sound smart. Whenever I was at that meeting, I would ponder the irony that at the hands of a nun upstairs, my departure from God started. And downstairs, with a bunch of coffee swilling, foul mouth, chain smoking old men, they brought me back to God. There's just something so AA about that. But so all that anger I had had at God had basically been beaten out of me, basically, had been beaten out of me. I was just like bewildered on steroids. I didn't know what to believe. If there's a God, great. He don't want nothing to do with me, and I'm still not so sure I want anything to do with him, but whatever. I mean, that's just kind of where I was. I was at bottom. I was done. I was flat, nothing. I got nothing. And I'll always be grateful to Dan for not shying away from the so-called spiritual side of the program as if there's another side. And these two, they did what we do. they started telling me a little bit about themselves. I had all kinds of people try to help me, good people who knew what my problem was, not the ones in that hospital, but good people who they knew, and they told me what my problem was. I could never hear them. Whenever push came to shove and I felt like I was going to give it to, I'm going to tell them how I really feel, I couldn't. They don't understand. They're judging me. They don't care. It's just a job. Don't tell them nothing. These two guys, Dan starts talking about knocking somebody out somewhere and then crawling around on his hands and knees, barking like a dog, biting anybody that would come near him while the cops are getting ready to give him some knowledge knots. Turns out Bob A got out of the nut house for trying to kill somebody. It's amazing who you feel safe with. I mean, these were my people. These were my people. The process of identification was happening. I knew that they knew. Identification has to happen before healing can take place. The early AAs learn that early on in the game. They learn that. Identification has to happen. When somebody gets up to tell their story and they say, "Well, y'all know how to drink or you wouldn't be here, so I'm not going to tell you any drunkalogue." Like as if the drunkalogue is like a horrible thing, a bad thing. Now, if you got an hour to talk and 55 minutes in, you're still crashing cars in the trees and you ain't mentioned the steps or God or AA once, then we got a problem, But those stories, those things that we did, the way that we felt is what builds the bridge between you and me. I know you know. I can hear you now. And Dan mentioned the word God. And I said, uh-oh, like full stop. I leaned forward. I said, "Is this a God thing?" And he goes, "Well, I mean, you could say that. We don't really look at it that way, but I mean, yeah, it's a God thing." And then he explained, just like straight out of the foreword to the 12 and 12, as I mentioned earlier during the presentation, a group of steps or a group of principles, spiritual in nature, when practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession of drinking and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. You want in or not? We ain't selling nothing here, y'all. We're giving it away. And it wasn't an arrogant, you want in or not. It was sincere. We're not going to try to ram anything down your throat. If you don't want it, that is absolutely fine. We think it'll work for you because it's worked for us, and by the looks of you, you look like us, but if you don't want it, and so I told him how angry I had been at God. I said, this ain't gonna work. This ain't gonna work. He says, "Why not?" I said, "You don't know what I've done to God." He started laughing. He said, "Well, that's an odd reaction." He says, "Mike, you can't hurt God. If you can hurt God, you need a bigger God." And I thought, "You can do that?" He says, "Yeah, you can do that." And then I told him how angry I'd been at God. He says, "Oh, my, being angry at God's not such a bad place to be." I said, "It's not." He says, "No, you can't be angry at something you don't believe in." I thought my head was going to explode. And then he said something else that I thought was original to him. We think our sponsors are the smartest people on the planet. He was a very smart guy, very helpful, and I love him forever. He passed away in 2009. I think of him every day, every single day. And but he said, this was actually Sam Shoemaker said it in his talk at the Coming of Age Convention in St. Louis, 1955, and he was quoting some Spanish philosopher. In my words, and in Dan's words, the Spanish philosopher was much more eloquent, no doubt, but said he said that what we found is that those that are the angriest at God are those that are the most hurt at not being able to find him. And I knew that that was true. I knew that that was true. And then he said something to me that changed my life, and I haven't been the same since. He said, "Mike, you're a sick person, not a bad person, and you're worth saving. You're worth saving." I was standing in front of a judge in 1971. Oh my God, he's going back to 1971. Anyway, I was standing in front of a judge in 1971 in DC, and the purpose of the hearing to see was if I was going to be allowed to go home before trial, which I knew wasn't going to happen since I didn't have a home. We're pretty smart that way. The thing I remember about that day, not one single person in that courtroom looked at me. Not one. The judge never made eye contact with me. District attorney never looked at me. Nobody looked at me. My own public defender didn't look at me. It was clear to me there wasn't a soul in that room that cared about me, not in that room, not in that building, not in that city, not on this planet that cared about me. And they turned me around to take me back to the cell block. I remember thinking to myself, maybe they're all right. You are useless. You are worthless. You're getting what you deserve. It wasn't true, but that's what I believed. Fast forward to February 24th, 1978, when Dan said to me, "You're a sick person, not a bad person, and you're worth saving." I cannot tell you what those words did to me. I rocked back in the seat, tears started streaming down my face, and I ain't embarrassed to tell you about it. And it was as if those words just busted open a hole in my chest, and the oxygen of God's love just started pouring in and feeding that glow that had always been there. And it got stronger and stronger and stronger now. I don't know. I didn't have a spiritual experience like Bill W. did, you know, the white light, the wind, not of air, but of grace. And I'm on a mountaintop. This is the God of the preachers. But I'll tell you what, it was not a slow educational variety either. When I got out of that car at the Southeast Southwest Boundary Group in Washington, D.C., I was a different man that got in that car. I knew you knew. I knew you had an answer, and I wanted it bad. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, what did you have? Well, first of all, it looked like y'all were sleeping indoors and you were eating regular. You didn't smell like I did, but it was more than that. What you had was something I'd been searching for all my life, and I didn't know it. I was searching for peace. That's all I wanted. I just wanted peace. That's all I wanted. You all seemed to have it. And you told me this is how we got it. You know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And they were very clear that, you know, it's Mike, nobody's going to tell you how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. You know, nobody's going to tell, you know, I got news for you. God's name isn't God. If you can name it, it's not God. God's not a he or a she. That would imply limitations. Can't be putting limitations on the one that has all power. Now, can we? They begged me not to get bogged down in vocabulary. They said, we are offering you access to something that has helped millions of alcoholics recover over the last, well, then it was 42 years, 8 months, and 2 weeks. You know, I've been sober longer than AA was alive back then. I don't get any brownie points for it or anything. But anyway, you know, we are giving you access to that. Call it what you want. You are going to be in rooms every night that are full of alcoholics who are not drinking. And most of the people in the room are happy about it. They're clean. Most of them are employed. Whatever problems they have, they are dealing with them in an effective and in a constructive way. They're not drinking over them. Most of the people are happy. They're glad to see each other. You call it what you want. We're giving you access to a power that can do that for you. You want in or not? I wanted in, and I wanted in bad. They sent me home that night with a box of chocolate donuts, a bottle of Cairo syrup, and a big book under my arm. And Dan told me, he said, whenever you want to drink, take a hit off of that Cairo syrup or eat a chocolate donut. And man, I'm reading a big book and I'm taking hits off of this Cairo syrup and shoving chocolate donuts in my mouth. And this is how my journey began. This is how I began to build a relationship with the God of my own conception. And it has worked for me. And he gave me the essentials, you know, the how, honesty, open mind, and willingness. He said, if you're willing, this thing can work for you, Mike. And they really pitched the one day at a time. You know, just don't drink today. You know, and I didn't. And I didn't. I kept coming back, and I have ever since. The obsession to drink was eventually lifted after about 3 months, so long 3 months. I never came close to drinking, but oh my God, one day I woke up, it was gone. It's just gone. It hasn't returned. So I went from a guy that used to sleep in the woods to today I'm a retired grandfather. So there's been some living going on in there. I have I have some things in my family that are just breaking my heart right now. I have somebody I love very much who's out there. It's extremely painful, extremely painful. I'm not mad at God. I still have gratitude. I'm mad at anybody. It's just this awful, awful thing called alcoholism. We're sober tonight in this room, and this group's been doing the deal for 20 years. And I think that that's awesome. That's great. And I hope you celebrate again next year because I'll be looking for a free meal. Anyway, thank you all so much for having me.